Our next speaker, Charles Richardson, has been a recording engineer in the Mid-Atlantic region since the 1970s. Reviewers say Charlie has a knack for recording acoustic material, acoustic musical performances that transport the listener into the music hall. Charles produced the Annapolis Sounds Masters in 1976. When he wanted to remaster Annapolis Sounds for a new CD in 2008, the tapes showed severe stickiness and were virtually unplayable. To save his masters, Charlie worked with forensic chemists to identify the source of sticky shed and develop a process and now a prototype of a machine that halts and can reverse deterioration in sticky tapes. Charles Richardson.
Can you, I need to get my program up. Bill, the program, I need to get mine up on the computer.
Cam, can you help him out with this?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No, I this is English, yes. I just, thank you.
Where is mine? Can you get my first page up? Maybe this one. No, that's into it too far. Get to the start of it.
There you go.
That's the start of it. Well, it's certainly a treat to be here, and I've certainly enjoyed Dr. Schuller's presentation, and it's great to meet and talk to you all. I've been working on this thing for a long time and have certainly a different perspective and point of view on this thing, and I've tried to back it up with as much thorough forensics science as I possibly could. This report right here is just one of a stack of about six forensic reports done on a few tapes. I think we've done some groundbreaking work of extraordinary quality. The thing that started me on this adventure was that I was a recording engineer in Annapolis, Maryland for a long time, and I was concerned that I was about to lose a life work for these on these recordings, which I valued, and I was very distressed and upset that, you know, all this stuff is going down the drain because of all these goo problems. And I did as much reading as I could, and I tried to find out what was wrong with it and what to do with it. And there certainly is a whole lot of variety of points of view, if you've heard of, as to the cause, a solution, and so forth. What I'm trying to do in this particular process and this stuff is actually a restoration process, not just detecting and, you know, explaining the history and stuff of it, but what do we actually do to fix these tapes, to get this sticky shed problem under control so we can restore it, preserve it, and not only have it last longer, but when we play these tapes, get them in the most possibly good condition, and therefore they will play superbly, last a long time, give you the best playbacks and the best digital transfers, as long as being used for backup for insurance purposes, digital comes and goes and so forth. So anyway, this Annapolis Sounds recording first started out in 1976. I recorded it on a lot of locations around the historic buildings of Annapolis. Annapolis is an old town. They have a lot of buildings which have a good acoustic, and there is quite a lot of artistic activity for a small town of our size. And I love recording in this music, and I'm doing everything that I can not only to save my work but also that of other people. And if I can help you all, I will certainly try to do it. As you heard from Dietrich, there's a lot of debate and discussion. There are different manufacturers, there are different problems. And one certainly can get down in the weeds on the chemical stuff if one wants to do it. I don't want to do it. I have a certain amount of background in chemistry, but I'm afraid, you know, we'd lose a lot of people. And if you're going to do this thing on a basis of really getting down to the chemistry, you sort of have to sit there a longer session, talk it out, and work some of these things. So let me show you what we try to do on this. This is our first picture here of a typical tape recorder where you've got the goo all over the heads. The goo, of course, creates a spacing loss. The spacing loss messes up the frequency response, causes squealing, wow, flutter, and all the rest of these things. But one thing that caught my eye and was very interesting is you see the debris on the tape lifter. And it's mostly black. Now, if all the hydrolysis problems were coming strictly from the oxide, you'd expect that debris material to be the brown oxide color. Well, this caught my attention because for the simple reason, the lifter is pushing against the oxide. It's not rubbing against the back coating. So what happened here is that the back coating came off of the back-coated side got onto the oxide side by contact reaction, contact contamination. When it ran over the guide, it flipped off onto the guide. And you also can see there's a fair amount of black mixed in with the brownish color of the goo that's on the head. So anyway, this is a major problem. Now, the tapes were originally made and recorded in 1976. By 1991, they were starting to get bad. They weren't as bad as this. But by 2000, they were this bad. And I couldn't play these things without, you know, terrible problems and trying to fix them, or so it sounded terrible. So I wanted to get to the bottom of this thing and come up with a process to restore and fix these darn tapes so I wouldn't have these problems. As Dietrich pointed out, there certainly has been a huge change in terms of tapes and the way they were made and coated and so forth. We have tapes made before 1970, usually have two elements. You have tapes after 1970 where they added the back coating. The back coating's primary reason was to help with mechanical issues such as static discharge, high-speed winding, and so forth, and it accomplished those goals. However, the problem with it is that there's a price to be paid for the back coating and its associated binder, which has taken us down this spiral of going to sort of a chemical hell and sticky shed. And I also noticed a number of other things, that the older tapes, which had only two constituent parts, conform to the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. When you put on another coating, you're asking for a whole lot more binder chemical, more chemical activity, more absorption of moisture, more kinds of things of that nature, and that's just simply the nature of the fact that you have that. Now, the lubricant layer that I show here is not typically done on tapes. That lubricant layer is just shown because sometimes they'll put an extra lubricant layer on there if you've got a really serious situation, such as 8-track cartridges, or you've got broadcast cartridges, but usually the lubricant's mixed in with it. Now, this next one is a diagram from Dr. Edward Cudahy of JPL Labs, who was the party who did a lot of work on these tapes in the early 70s and 80s. And he was doing this because NASA was having severe problems with the instrumentation tapes for the space program. Well, this is his drawing, and of course you see if you look at the left, you have a made tape. If you move toward the right, you're taking it apart analytically, and then of course you move further left, you take it apart even further. Well, of course you can use these diagrams and these things to analyze different components of the tape, and you also see, of course, the oxide particles and other particles that mixed it. So if you were starting the other direction from the left and moving right, you could say make these ingredients, put it together, and do it that way. The thing that he left out of this is, of course, the urethane binder family has a family of about 900 different chemicals, and that's why you're seeing what Dietrich was talking about, all these European tapes and our tapes having different stuff, because they have such a wide range of chemical capabilities. And when you change from something like gamma ferric oxide to chromium dioxide, you have this acidic and the things you were talking about. And so when you change sometimes the content of the particles, you have to readjust the binder. And if you don't, you've got problems. And when you do that, you may have other problems. But my focus, I don't have the range that he does and Bassif does of all these tapes of different ages, you know, purposes and so forth. I'm more confined to the things that I was using, and so my range of experiments and stuff is more narrow than his, but I think some of the basic stuff that I find applies to a whole lot more tapes. It's not just strictly restricted to that. Plus the fact I did some work with the videotapes and found that the process I was doing and the analysis of the problems applied to a lot of the videotapes. Trouble is, video is extremely hard to handle. But anyway, here's the basic finding that Cudahy and Bertram made, and this is something you really need to concentrate on and see if you can get a concentrated understanding of this, and I don't know whether I can explain it as well as I'd like. But anyway, their finding was, after 6 years of exhausting laboratory work, 6 papers. I mean, you know, these guys didn't leave any stone unturned trying to do this because they're working for the government trying to save the data for these space programs. But anyway, if we take the ester as a general category of the chemicals, and we have polyester and in the base films and so forth, and when it is exposed to moisture, the H2O plus, it goes to the right and starts to generate carboxyl fatty acid, and it also tends to generate an alcohol. Now, the alcohol is a real bad guy because that stuff is pretty powerful, and it attacks the ester and leaves behind the carboxyl fatty acid type stuff, and that's what does a lot of the clogging you saw on the head surfaces and the squealing and so forth. Now, they also found that if you drop the level of humidity very low, this process will reverse because the atoms are in the form of ions, hydrogen ion and OH ion. If you get the humidity down, you can get this thing to reverse. And by reversal, it means going back to close to what it was before it started having the problem. So when you have these organic chemicals, you've got an environmentally controlled situation factored in by the chemicals, and it's controlled by heat and moisture going back and forth what you have. Here's his graph of trying to see what's going on with this thing. And of course, up in the dark area is very unacceptable because that's absorbing a lot of moisture. When it does, it gets soft, and you run the risk of either scraping it off, as we saw in the example, scraping it off the tape, or having all kinds of problems with the magnetic information because it's gotten moved around. Well, the middle area in this picture, of course, is for marginal use, and that works out all right. And then you get in a better area at the bottom of the graph where you can see it that way. Along the curving line in the middle is what they found to be the optimal storage thing of 65% humidity, 40% humidity for this particular tape, and there may be some variations. Now, when you look at this picture, don't think that this thing is something that is set in concrete. Again, we're dealing with organic chemicals which have variations, and so this chart is sort of a snapshot and can vary depending on circumstances. The next one is just sort of a snapshot picture of it. It shows what's going on at a fixed temperature of 36 degrees centigrade, 94 degrees Fahrenheit. And you can see the ramp up, that if you go up the hill in a high humidity environment, it starts to take in more moisture and gets heavier and stickier and so forth. But notice the reverse reaction is what people typically miss, or they don't understand. The reverse reaction is the one down there that says zero relative humidity. And that's where this process reverses, the weight goes down, the moisture is taken out and so forth. The thing we would like to get to and to stay with is the 30% flatline situation in which we have relative humidity at that level and that temperature, because when you can achieve what's called equilibrium stability, then these changes stop, the tape is fairly stable, and you don't have a lot of these problems. Now, look at the bottom line of this thing. When you see the time of weeks exposure, you can see that one of the reasons why Kudahy's methods did not become very popular, or at least are not very well understood, and of course the reverse reaction that depends upon it, is how long it takes for this thing to work. We have down here just a simple example of making this change. Well, that's 20 weeks. There can be other cases in which it takes not only weeks, it can take months or it takes years. Well, you people, as practical people trying to handle your tapes and do stuff and master things out, you can't sit around and wait for this thing to get on the train and come back to it. So anyway, that's a sort of thing. Now, here's the sticky shed contamination, at least is the way that I found it. If you look at the upper picture in the little box, and of course off to the right, there's a tail end of this thing. The tail end is what usually the chemists will chop that off as a sample, and they'll put that sample in some solutions and do their acetone extractions and so forth. But we need to look a little closer at this thing. Kudahy was doing that. In other words, he would cut off a piece of sample and analyze it. But one thing that he missed that's very important is the fact that these tapes are wound up on reels. And the only time a section of tape is off the reel is, you know, the head end, the tape end, or a section of it, which you're going to use for playback. The rest of the time, it's stored up on reels. Now, the problem is for us as chemists or engineers or anybody else is to be able to see what the hell is going on in those layers between the reels. It's next to impossible to do it. How are you going to put a probe in there? How are you going to watch it? These things change subtly, slowly, over long periods of time, and they'll escape your notice unless you do all kinds of documentation. So anyway, that's where it goes. And we found it was Kudahy's finding, and he said this in one of his papers, and it's the key to this whole thing. He said the carbon black back coating is the tape's most deteriorated component. It's acting like a moisture sponge. Well, folks, if moisture is a problem for the oxide, the last thing you want to do is put a moisture sponge against it. So that, I think, is a key reason Why this distinction between tapes before 1970 that didn't have this and the ones that came afterward do have these problems? Now, I'm not saying it happens in every case. I'm not saying that's a flat, absolute rule, but it certainly is a general one. This is what we have with the losses of the gap losses and so forth when you have a tape that's in good shape up above where it has a nice good contact with the tape surfaces and where it also too has a good contact at the gap. In the bottom, when you see the debris and stuff collecting on the head surfaces to the left and right of the gap, which causes it to squeal, and in the middle of the gap, if it collects there, it pushes the oxide away from the surface, causing spacing losses. Now, this is what the scientists that I work with used to analyze these tapes and look at them up close. And folks, if you really want to know something, you got to look at it. And a picture may be worth 1,000 words, and maybe sometimes a microscopic picture is worth 1,000,000 words. But listen, this thing is a surface scanning electron microscope, and it can really get down there and let you look at these things. And this kind of information supplements what you're doing by, you know, all the other different kinds of tests that you do. What the electron microscope does is it goes over the surface of the tape in a scanning fashion. It shoots electrons at a high voltage to the surface, then the images are generated from this, so you can see all kinds of detail that you can't see otherwise. Here's the first picture. On the left is a standard ordinary sponge, not magnified, on the left-hand side that's green. On the right is a picture of the back coating at 400 times magnification. You can see sort of a surface structural similarity, so there's no, you know, doubt that it lends itself to absorbing moisture, which we really don't want to do. And this is what Dr. Cody found in 1980, and this is why he made his comment, because there it is. Now here's another comparison picture, side by side, 400 times magnification. On the right-hand side, you see the back coating, carbon black back coating. On the left-hand side, you see the oxide. On the oxide surface, look at all that splotching stuff. That splotching stuff is debris that came off of the back coating and got on the oxide. Now, many people think that the oxide is the bad guy and it's falling apart and its problem is with the binder and everything else. Well, folks, a lot of times the binder for the oxide is in pretty good shape. The trouble is it's buried underneath these problems. So I'm going to keep going further fasting. This one is a picture of 800 magnification. Look at all the variation due to the aging of the thing. You've got certain particles that are black and the rest of it, but you've also got a situation in which the color is changing, and the reason it's changing is there's an ingrowth of mold and fungus, which you don't want. Here you get another chance. This is looking at the oxide where you see carbon particles. You've got mold fringing the particles. You've got carboxyl fatty acid filling in the areas between the particles. Now this is that same picture we just saw of the oxide after I cleaned it with a new process. Look at how clean that is. The stuff is gone, and you're not using your tape head as a scraper to get the damn stuff off, because it's been taken off, and this surface is very clean, low friction, and does the job. Here's a side-by-side comparison. The oxide before and the oxide after. You see how much cleaning it is, and if you just leave the stuff on there, or if you just cook the tapes, you're not doing a dang thing to clean up the mess. You have to get in there, roll up your sleeves, get in there, and get the stuff off of it. Also, too, on the right-hand side, oxide afterward, you can see there's another slight color change because the goo has been taken off and the brown oxide is getting closer to the surface, so that's helpful. I'm getting close to the end here. The picture on the right is a piece of tape with the back coating halfway still on and the other part has been removed. The brown bottom part is the reason you see that is because the back coating has been removed and you're looking through the base film and seeing the oxide from the back side. The other strip of tape over on the left side is harder to see in terms of the picture here because the upper part is sort of dingy and dark and so forth, but it's cleaned up lower and you can really see it, and the colors start to closely match each other. Now, if you can't see it from this picture or you have any qualms about it, I've got 3 or 4 samples up here. You're more than welcome to come up and take a look at it afterwards and see what you think about how it's done. Now, this is the summary of this thing. The new process cleans the oxide surface, removes the carbon black back coating products from the base film. It allows for immediate superb playback. You're not sitting here struggling trying to get this dang tape to behave itself. You put it on, play it, do your work, get what you want. It produces excellent sonic and mechanical performance, and it accelerates the reverse reaction of the tape. For heaven's sakes, folks, if you remove a lot of this goo and you remove the back coating, you don't have this junk around anymore to produce acid, alcohol, moisture, particles, or fungus. And that's a hell of an improvement. We also then, we preserve the original tape for a long lifespan, so this changes our expectations and all this work that's been done on how long things last and so forth. So it's a whole different ball game. This is a prototype of the machine that I was using to do experiments on cleaning and different materials and how to do it. This thing needs to be developed and put further forward. So the end of this thing, the end of this talk is that we've come back, made full circle to the early tapes that he was saying, you know, up to 1970 are the good tapes, and we had problems after 1970. We have chemically and mechanically simplified the tape, and when we get this stuff off, it dries out, it reverses, and we have a nice tape. This is a little thing about me. I've got a preprint, and that's the end of my discussion. I thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Oh, before we go, can I get you to play one selection? It's channel cut 22. It lasts a minute, and I want you to hear this thing because it's, to me, sounds almost as good as the day it was made. Let's just hear it. Turn it. No, you've cut it off. It's a minute. It started up. 22. That's it. Now, before I get to questions, I'll just tell a little story about that. It's a nice processional. I love to record the organ. It's a beautiful instrument. I wish we could really crank it up and blast you out here. But anyway, it's a beautiful piece, and there are lots of these other things on the recording. But anyway, I wrote a little note in the Annapolis Sounds things, and I said, any bride who uses this piece for her processional is giving musical notice. She's a force to be reckoned with. And the groom has about 60 seconds before he gets tied up with she who must be obeyed. So anyway, thanks very much for your attention. Appreciate it.
We have more than 10 minutes for questions, but I have a quick announcement. Jim Farrington wanted me to let everybody know that the silent auction items are available for pickup in a calm, orderly manner.
I unfortunately used Ampex 456 for many, many, many years, and one of its problems, even when we didn't think it had any others, was that it was subject to print through. You could have an editing project on your machine, take a break for lunch, and by the time you got back from lunch, the tape had printed through. By removing the back coating, it's bound to make the print through worse, and what can be done about that?
I have not had such problems. I haven't been a big user of 456 as you have been, and also, too, I don't know what your levels were, the frequency, that makes some difference. But let me finish my thing. The distance does change, but you know, one of the other things, too, that is really bad if you want to make print through worse is when you heat the blasted tapes up and bake them, there is definitive evidence that heat also increases print through. And I'm not saying that's your particular situation, but all I can say is we could do the measurements and find out what you're doing. I'm sure you're right that a slightly thinner tape is going to make a small difference, But if I have to trade that off to make the thing play and not squeal, that's, you know, a trade-off I would make.
Okay. I have a question. What tape is it which you have been treating? Is this one brand? Is it one type? Or are there many?
I was treating mostly the Ampex tapes. I had 406, 407. I was using 456. I also did some experiments on Scotch, on Agfa, and Bassif and stuff. I mean, you know, you can't do an in-depth study on all these things, and I'm trying to save my work rather than trying to be in a laboratory sort of situation.
It is my observation, but this needs to be confirmed by you on this in this part of the world, that most of the early chemical analysis have been made, Bertram and Goody have made on Ampex tapes. Ampex 406, 407. Also the Australian publications have been made on Ampex 406, 407, because these were the tapes that shipped over the Pacific and arrived in a precondition for getting sticky after 2 months of the way on the sea. Also in the Netherlands, this tape was used, and Manchester Polytechnics, Norman Allen, and made a lot of publications. And my guess is that most of these publications, which give this very clear view of the chemical situation, what happens, is based on Ampex. If another tape would have been researched, probably other conclusions would have been made. So this is my suspicion. Please look into that. You may come to. I would be happy if whatever your answer is.
Can I respond a little bit to that? Yes, he's right. A lot of it was made on Ampex tape. The Kudahy stuff was made on their instrumentation tapes. As I said, I did other studies on Scotch and other tapes. Now, those are not as bad. It's different, but they all of the tapes that I could clean up with this process benefited terrifically by reducing the amount of materials that are in there, the moisture activity, the moisture materials, and so forth. So it was helpful to anything that I could use it on. I just, you know, don't have the means to sit here and take into account everybody's particular situation, but it certainly was helpful on what I could do.
Yes. I'd like to kind of follow up on your comment, Mr. Richardson, and maybe direct this question to Dietrich. The question of the effects of baking. Dietrich, did you speak with the gentleman in Europe about, what effects there may be of baking long-term? There are certainly some engineers who've suggested that there's a high-frequency drop-off from baking. Mr. Richardson mentioned some print-through issues. That would be the first part of my question, and the second part would be, what about repeated baking for tapes that are baked for the second or third times? Thank you.
Who do you want?
No, I said it, and one of my slides also says it. They both the baking activities they that have been performed by both ACFA and BSF on their own tapes, yeah, have been for the purpose of recovering the content. They left the original tapes generally with the proprietors, with the studios, and did not worry what has happened later. None of them have had any explanation of what had happened later. I think Münzener, but I have to look at the interview again, once said it comes back again, which is a general experience. But they do not know what had happened to the tapes. They are no archivists. Yeah. They wanted to rescue the content.
Yeah. What about the effects on the sound of baking?
Obviously, everybody was happy with the results. Otherwise, they would have been bashed by the customers. You see, I cannot say more. This is one outside the scope of their actions.
May I add to that a little bit? I wouldn't have done what I've done if I thought baking was great. I really wouldn't. And I went to the chemist and I said, what about this? A lot of people use it. They use it because they need to, or have to. Maybe it works or something like that. The chemist said, baking is for cookies. It's not for tapes. And also, you cannot single out tapes as an exception to the bad effects of heat, aging, shorting the lifespan, and doing all kinds of stuff you don't want to do. Baking accelerates the hydrolysis thing, even though you may get it to stop squealing for a time. The squealing and the problems come back not long afterwards, and that's a clear indication from the chemicals they don't like it being treated that way. With respect to your question as to the sound quality, when you have a thin coating of goo on top of the magnetic particles, if you don't remove that goo and you heat it up with the baking, it starts to heat cure that layer of goo, which means you're building into your tape progressively as you bake it a hard layer of gooey stuff, which is increasing spacing loss problems, and that's why you're having these high frequency losses.
All right, I have a question. What do you do when you have a reel of tape that has splices and leader tape concerning cleaning the tape? What happens when you hit splices?
Yes. Seth, I want to also, first of all, thank you so much for the album you did on Bürgeling. It was terrific. I loved it. So
which
thank
one?
You. The UC Bürgeling.
Oh, Bürgeling.
Bürgeling, I'm sorry. I get it wrong.
There's another one coming.
Okay, that's great. With regard to splices, the machine would be set up that I have in mind to detect the splices and pass over them and not to do them any damage. Or on the other hand, if you have a splice and you're trying to clean the process with this process here, it may be a case that you want to redo the splices. And what I found out is this, that if you have a splice on the back side of a back coated tape, a lot of times those things age pretty quickly and get sticky or they're weak or whatever it is. So what might be done, or the smarter thing to do if you have the time and can do it, is to redo the splices if you want to really put the time into it and clean off the area of the tape underneath the splice that had all the goo in the back coating and then redo the splice onto the base film. It's so much better and lasts longer. Now, this is a bother, and the machine and the process that I have in mind is not an automatic splicing machine. The only thing that I would try to do and build into it is it would detect the splice as it comes to be cleaned, stop it, pass over it, and go on.
Can mechanically stop it at that point.
That's right. That's right.
Repair the splice and then
continue. That's right. Exactly. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's what I was asking, because of the fact that if that splice opens, how are you going to get it through the machine if you have it in two?
Absolutely. You're right. And it's the point is well taken, and we have it in mind. We have it in mind.
I just have a personal experience to related to what Brad McCoy said just a few minutes ago. I had a few years back, I learned a lesson. The conventional wisdom we were told about baking tapes is that you had a 30-day window of opportunity to transfer that tape to another medium once it was baked. A few years back, I had a project involving three 10.5-inch reels of tape that had to be transferred, and another project that involved a single reel. I threw them all in the oven at the same time. The next day, I went to the three-reel project, transferred it, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
13 days later, I went to the other reel, and it had already started to go bad.
Yeah.
I had no choice but to bake it a second time. It would not play. So my advice is plan your work accordingly. If you're going to bake a tape, transfer it. Okay, whether or not we should bake tapes is a separate issue, but if you are baking tapes, plan to transfer it within a day or two, because in 2 weeks it may be bad again.
Yeah, and this is the price you pay, and the problem you have is that you've got these issues you just mentioned. One of the other reasons why I did this process and why I like it is because I take the stuff off of there that's causing the problem. You're not going to have to ever process this thing a second time. Once this is cleaned with a new process, that's it. It stays the way it should be. You don't have to do any sort of secondary remedial stuff. I took one of these tapes that I had restored. I could play it any time I wanted to with perfect fidelity, no mechanical problems. I took one tape, played it 300 times without any problems. And the only reason I stopped is because I was putting a lot of wear on the heads, but it was just in beautiful shape. Because we fixed the problems. Instead of trying to find remedies around the problems, we actually fixed it. So I hope that's what people would want. Yes?
No, we'll come over to you. We got two ahead of you, John.
Okay.
There are a number of issues that came up here that I have serious questions about. The first is, I think that there's a fatal flaw in your process. And that is that when you are unreeling the tape and the tape is adhering as you're feeding it off, you have no way of protecting yourself from that tape chipping and leaving blank oxide. So any so you're inevitably going to pull a piece off on some of the tapes that you would be processing. You may have been fortunate here it didn't happen on yours, but it has happened. I've seen it happen.
No, I have an answer to that.
Well, all right, let me continue.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's work on the one.
That one. Yes, that is, tapes are in all different kinds of shape. You don't want to be reeling it off and losing chips and pieces like you're talking about. Before you run it through the machine, you check it to see if it has those particular kinds of problems.
It's on the inside of the tape.
Well, I figured out, if I notice it starting to do that, I know what to do to remediate it or to stop it from doing more. I mean, I've faced that problem and I have an answer for it, but I can't go into all the details right now. But if it's starting to do that, there is a way, there may be a necessity, and I'm saying this is a necessity of the situation you're talking to. You may have to apply a certain amount of localized low-level heat in order to get the thing to detach so it doesn't rip it off the way you're talking about. But what I'm saying is I'm assuming this machine is going to get in a tape that's not ripping it off. Now, if it is, this isn't going to put it back on. If it's a problem that we can solve before you start to process it through my system, that's what you do. But I'm here to try and save tape.
It's not going to put it back on because it's not going to put it back on. It's already been removed.
I know it won't put it back on, but do you have a method either to put it on or to keep it from coming off?
Yes, it's called either baking or closing it or running the temperature very low and storing it at a low temperature.
All right. If you have to do it in that particular case, fine. Then do that what you need to do and then apply them in afterward. I'm not saying you never ever would bake a tape. I'm saying you try to minimize it. If that cures your problem, you've solved it that far, and then you take it on to my process once you're satisfied with that.
There's no reason to use your process.
So you can play the tape a month or two or three or months later or years later.
That's right.
You can only play it if you're with.
Okay.
Wait till we get it on the tape.
All right. There is a lot of anecdotal discussion about what happens when you bake tape. I have not seen anybody who's checked to see if any high frequency has been lost after baking or after baking a multiple period of times. I have not seen that there's been any problem with the kind of clumping you're talking about on tape that's been baked a number of times. All this is to promote other possible solutions to the problem. I'm speaking now of American tapes. I would like to see a study that goes into all of these aspects as well as all the other possible ways of doing this.
I've done a great deal of the very things you're talking about. I just don't have time now to talk about it.
It's a little past 12:30, so if anyone wants to leave, feel free, don't be embarrassed. But this is a very important discussion, so I think anyone who wants to stay will keep recording the questions and answers.
I just want to make one general observation. Baking is an invasive process. But stripping off the back coat is a highly invasive process. And I would question the statement that we're increasing the longevity of the tape by your process without some real hard evidence. I'm also wondering if you can tell us how you take off the back coating.
The back coating is removed by a mechanical process if possible. If not, it's done by chemical assistance. I realize what you say is exactly the case. It is an invasive process. We did all the testing and checking to make sure we weren't doing any harm or any damage. I mean, I wouldn't do this if it were a disaster. And I have much more evidence and stuff in my files, which, again, I don't have time to do this. And the results are superb. I mean, it's just not mind-boggling how good it is and how well it works. I can understand
great.
The concern, but we fixed it.
Have you published your results?
I published a paper in AES a number of years ago. I've done a whole lot of research work since. I'm looking forward to maybe doing another paper with ARSC or other people. I've got a stack of paper this thick just on the lab reports. I've got another stack of stuff that's about 6 or 7 feet tall of things I've done and so forth. I mean, we've done our homework.
I think making your results available would be a very useful thing to pursue.
I'd be delighted to do it. Be delighted to.
Assuming that we get to the point where archivally we agree with what you've said, and I'm neither agreeing or disagreeing, I think it sounds interesting, but to be honest, I don't know enough to know how much long-term damage it does, and I'd like to see the results that you mentioned when you have the chance to publish them or make them available online or whatever. But my question is, how practical is this going to be for archives to do? I mean, is this something that's going to be sold as a unit that can be purchased by an archive or by an engineer? Is this something where the tapes will have to be sent out to an organization that you've contracted with? I understand it's in the embryonic stages, but that's all you've talked about. You haven't talked about how one would make this practical if indeed it is the best way to go.
Well, that's a great question, and it's certainly one to be done. As I say, I can't do all this stuff at once. This is a preliminary thing. Those questions you asked are exactly right on the money. What this requires is a machine to be made that's precise, automated, and does this stuff. There are all kinds of possibilities. You might have somebody who is a dealer who buys it, who sends it out, or all kinds of things. But, you know, crossing those bridges, I'd be glad to do it when the machine gets further down the road. And I certainly want to take care of everybody or have this thing as widely available as possible in a sensible and reasonable fashion. But I can't, you know, cross all these bridges right now. I have to do the other work. Go ahead.
I realize you're in the testing and design stage still, but if you do use a chemical to remove the carbon backcoat, have you checked the chemical results with the reaction that it has with the rest of the tape to see what the long-term effects are on that tape? And then also, how long does it take to clean or remove the backcoat with your method on a normal size tape? In what size tape? 12-inch, okay.
Yeah.
1,200 feet.
What was the first part of the question? I've forgotten.
Have you done a test on the chemical and how it affects the tape?
Absolutely.
Long term.
Absolutely. The chemical work has been done. The laboratory has certified that everything is safe. There is no damage. We take particular pains to restrict whatever chemical we use to the removal of the back coating only. Don't allow any of this stuff to get onto the oxide. In terms of how long it takes to clean it, I'm going to make an estimate. If the machine is designed properly and does its job the way it's supposed to do, my estimate is that it'd take anywhere from 4 hours to 8 hours to do a 2,500-foot long tape. Now, the reason it is because you've got to do multiple types of cleanings on the two surfaces. It's not going to be something that's going to whiz through the machine. And I'd like to make it fast, but the thing that holds it up are the chemical properties of these materials, and they have to be handled in a certain way. You can't just write up a formula and say, we're going to get this thing through this machine in 15 minutes. It won't work. So you have to let the chemicals run the process, yes.
Charles, do you have some kind of benchmark since you've started working on this process that you've got a set of tapes that you've processed X number of years ago at this point, I would assume?
Yes.
And you've looked at how those tapes have fared down the road, and you have some way of measuring quantitatively what the difference has been when you first processed the tapes and how they've fared X number of months or years later.
Yes, I appreciate that. This is why this process has taken me so long to do, because I've been doing exactly what you say. The chemists have done this stuff, and it's in the reports. You get the immediate benefit. The cleaning material is put on so quickly and taken off so quickly, there's hardly any chance for it to do anything. The recording that we just played is from a almost 40-year-old tape, that organ. I periodically check this thing every 6 months to see how it's doing. I can't find any changes. And as a matter of fact, in my opinion, that those tapes have gotten better over the time, and they were in terrible shape in 91. They were just awful in 2000. Today, they're pretty darn close to being what they were when they were new because, number one, we got rid of a lot of that destructive acid-eating, alcohol-eating material. And secondly, we put it in the condition that Dr. Kudahy did of reversing a reaction. So I've got, you know, there's almost 14 years worth of time that's gone under the bridge on checking these tapes, so I think we've got a pretty good situation.
Other than just listening to the tape, have you taken any tapes maybe that have a blank section, or you have some blank tape, at least recorded some test tones on those tapes and used it for a quantitative measured analysis months or
yeah,
years later?
We did that once and found there was no problem. We didn't find any problems.
Yes, the recording you played for us was quite impressive. I had a question in terms of you removing the back coating from the backside. I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how it's removed from the oxide side and what effect it has on the actual recorded side of the tape, the process.
The process takes into account the properties of the two sides and does exactly what's needed for each side, and also does it to be safe. The processing of the oxide side has to be, of course, extremely careful and precise so you don't do any damage. I have up here 3 or 4 samples on a reel, and I'm delighted for anybody who wants to come up and take a look at it. And you can see that it's just as smooth and nice and free of debris and stuff as it can be. I mean, I've done as much as I can, and I think that might answer your questions if you want to take a look at the sample. But that's it.
I would like to make a general remark. The method which you are describing may very well work for the very tapes for which you have developed them. Mm-hmm. But I'm after the experience I've made also with the interviews of the other manufacturers, it may not be not be recommendable to try that on any tape. So this is my point. I would also like to come back to what has been said earlier. Of course, tape incubation is an invasive process, and we have to look at it, what it really does. Different tapes again may react differently in the long term, and so it will be very difficult to assess the danger for the eternal life, if we attempt that, of the magnetic tape. We should always take into account that the replay devices will not be stay very long with us. And one remark to high frequency loss after baking, I have no theoretical background to understand that. And this is, I think, the first thing we should look into. Why should high frequencies be lost? Probably, and this comes back to the last argument, because the surface of the bake tapes are uneven or whatever, and then we have space losses for the highest frequencies, specifically in low speed recordings. Yeah.
Just one adding on to that, one small thing. Moisture, of course, is the same everywhere. These chemicals have varieties, like he's saying. I'd be happy to work with anybody who wants to check out other models of tape. As I say, I can't do everything and put the whole bottle, a ball of wax, on your plate. Anybody who wants to do these other experiments or work, I'm delighted to work with them. Plus the fact that even in these other tapes, you're dealing with families of chemicals which may have similarities or differences, no matter whether it's made in this country or other places. So there are lots of things to work on if you want to. If you really want to get down in the weeds, there's lots to work on.
I want to point out that, as we heard from Dietrich earlier, and then Jean-Louis during the plenary yesterday, that one of the things that has stymied us finding a solution to the squealing problem is that there's such a variety in the materials that from manufacturer to manufacturer, from Europe to the States, batch to batch, that just as there is a large variety of sources in the chemistry and manufacturing, we may find that there may be a wide range of solutions, that for this, we do it this way. And the differences that I may have with some of the observations, or any of us may have, I nonetheless want to applaud Charlie for taking the initiative and looking into this and developing a process. And the and I was speaking to Bill Ray during Jean-Louis' presentation, that after all the work that they spent looking in the sticky shed at the Image Permanent Institute, they came away with, we don't know. That's a perfectly valid outcome in a research project. Yeah. So all of these avenues, we need to be open-minded and encouraged people to undertake.
Yeah, I appreciate that. One point I was trying to make is when you get that gooey stuff off, the friction goes down, and that's a godsend, you know, to anybody who's doing this stuff. But I'm delighted to work on these things as people see fit, and what I did was save my own work. If I could help save other people's work or spread this out to something else, I'd be happy to do it.
Can I ask one other question? Concerning all these treatments and everything we're talking about, this is concerning pretty much 1.5 mil tape, correct? Because that's essentially what all professional engineers use for mastering.
It's 1.5, but I did do some work on 1 mil tape.
Okay.
Now, half mil is starting to get a little difficult because it's so damn fragile, and half mil is not all that widely used. But
I've never heard of a half mil blackback coated tape.
I'm just saying in terms of the physical thickness.
Right. No, but I'm talking about specifically 1 mil.
No problem.
No problem, because I can tell you that Ampex 407, according to what the research said, you were able to get 4 desiccations out of a tape before you couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, I know, like what Gary had said before, I had a reel of 406 that I remember desiccating, was able to play without a problem, and then I had to go back to it, about 4 months later. I re-desiccated it. I couldn't retrieve anything off the tape. It would not react properly. Yeah. Whereas 406, which was the 1.5 mil, and in Scotch 208, you could retrieve a second time. But it seems to be the 1 mil formulations is something that we have to look into also concerning retrieval, because there are a lot more consumers out there than studios were that were using that for their lengths.
Yeah.
And this is that was one thing that really bothered me, because I was under the assumption, okay, I can rebake this a second time, and I had some real major problems on that retrieval. Yeah.
Maybe I have some suggestions or thoughts that might help you on that.
Okay.
When you go from 1.5 mil down to 1 mil, of course, you're dropping the mylar base coating.
Right.
But also, too, you may be having thinner coatings for the oxide and the back coating just to keep the thing thinner. Well, the baking or whatever treatment that worked for 1.5 mil may not work for 1 mil, because either you went over a limit or something happened or whatever it is like that. So these are all chemical and mechanical things.
Yeah. Okay. Have we had enough?
Thank you for listening. I appreciate it.